Chapter 58. Wife by settling on her the half of his property, and with chivalrous devotion towards another and greater woman by sharing her fate, was possible. And though he meant to adhere to Eustacia's instructions to the letter, to deposit her where she wished, and to leave her, should that be her will, the spell that S.E. had cast over him intensified, and his heart was beating fast in the anticipated futility of such commands, in the face of a mutual wish, that they should throw in their lot together. He would not allow himself to dwell long upon these conjectures, maxims, and hopes, and at 11:40 he again went softly to the stable, harnessed the horse, and lit the lamps, whence, taking the horse by the head, he led him with the covered car out of the yard to a spot by the roadside some quarter of a mile below the inn. Here Wilde waited, slightly sheltered from the driving rain by a high bank that had been cast up at this place. Along the surface of the road, where lit by the lamps the loosened gravel and small stones scudded and clicked together before the wind, which, leaving them in heaps, plunged into the heath and boomed across the bushes into darkness. Only one sound rose above this din of weather, and that was the roaring of a 10-hatch weir to the southward, from a river in the meads which formed the boundary of the heath in this direction. He lingered on in perfect stillness till he began to fancy that the midnight hour must have struck. A very strong doubt had arisen in his mind, if Eustacia would venture down the hill in such weather, yet knowing her nature he felt that she might. "Poor thing! 'Tis like her ill luck," he murmured. At length he turned to the lamp and looked at his watch. To his surprise it was nearly a quarter past midnight. He now wished that he had driven up the circuitous road to Mistover, a plan not adopted, because of the enormous length of the route in proportion to that of the pedestrian's path down the open hillside, and the consequent increase of labor for the horse. At this moment a footstep approached, but the light of the lamps, being in a different direction, the comer was not visible. The step paused, then came on again. "Eustacia?" said Wilde. The person came forward, and the light fell upon the form of Klim, glistening with wet, whom Wilde immediately recognized. But Wilde, who stood behind the lamp, was not at once recognized by Eobright. He stopped as if in doubt whether this waiting vehicle could have anything to do with the flight of his wife or not. The sight of Eobright at once banished Wilde's sober feelings, who saw him again as the deadly rival from whom Eustacia was to be kept at all hazards. Hence Wilde did not speak, in the hope that Klim would pass by without particular inquiry. While they both hung thus in hesitation, a dull sound became audible above the storm and wind. Its origin was unmistakable. It was the fall of a body into the stream in the adjoining mead, apparently at a point near the weir. Both started. "Good God! Can it be she?" said Klim. "Why should it be she?" said Wilde, in his alarm forgetting that he had hitherto screened himself. "Ah! That's you, you traitor, is it?" cried Eobright. "Why should it be she?" "Because last week she would have put an end to her life, if as he had been able. She ought to have been watched. Take one of the lamps, and come with me." Eobright seized the one on his side and hastened on. Wilde did not wait to unfasten the other, but followed at once along the meadow track to the weir, a little in the rear of Klim. Shadwater Weir had at its foot a large circular pool, 50 feet in diameter, into which the water flowed through 10 huge hatches, raised and lowered by a winch, and cogs in the ordinary manner. The sides of the pool were of masonry, to prevent the water from washing away the bank. But the force of the stream in winter was sometimes such as to undermine the retaining wall, and precipitate it into the hole. Klim reached the hatches, the framework of which was shaken to its foundations by the velocity of the current. Nothing but the froth of the waves could be discerned in the pool below. He got upon the plank bridge over the race, and holding to the rail, that the wind might not blow him off, crossed to the other side of the river. There he leant over the wall, and lowered the lamp, only to behold the vortex formed at the curl of the returning current. Wilt of meanwhile had arrived on the former side, and the light from Eobright's lamp shed a flecked and agitated radiance across the weir pool, revealing to the ex-engineer the tumbling courses of the currents from the hatches above. Across this gashed and puckered mirror a dark body was slowly borne by one of the backward currents. "Oh, my darling!" exclaimed Wildov in an agonized voice, and, without showing sufficient presence of mind, even to throw off his greatcoat, he leaped into the boiling cauldron. Eobright could now also discern the floating body, though but indistinctly, and imagining from Wildov's plunge that there was life to be saved he was about to leap after. Bethinking himself of a wiser plan, he placed the lamp against a post, to make it stand upright, and running round to the lower part of the pool, where there was no wall, he sprang in and boldly waded upwards towards the deeper portion. Here he was taken off his legs, and in swimming was carried round into the center of the basin, where he perceived Wildov struggling. While these hasty actions were in progress here, Venn and Thomason had been toiling through the lower corner of the heath in the direction of the light. They had not been near enough to the river to hear the plunge, but they saw the removal of the carriage lamp, and watched its motion into the mead. As soon as they reached the car and horse, Venn guessed that something new was amiss, and hastened to follow in the course of the moving light. Venn walked faster than Thomason, and came to the weir alone. The lamp placed against the post by Klim still shone across the water, and the Riddleman observed something floating motionless. Being encumbered with the infant, he ran back to meet Thomason. "Take the baby, please, Mrs. Wildov," he said hastily. "Run home with her, call the stable lad, and make him send down to me any men who may be living near. Somebody has fallen into the weir." Thomason took the child and ran. When she came to the covered car, the horse, though fresh from the stable, was standing perfectly still, as if conscious of misfortune. She saw for the first time whose it was. She nearly fainted, and would have been unable to proceed another step, but that the necessity of preserving the little girl from harm nerved her to an amazing self-control. In this agony of suspense she entered the house, put the baby in a place of safety, woke the lad and the female domestic, and ran out to give the alarm at the nearest cottage. Diggory, having returned to the brink of the pool, observed that the small upper hatches or floats were withdrawn. He found one of these lying upon the grass, and taking it under one arm, and with his lantern in his hand, entered at the bottom of the pool as Klim had done. As soon as he began to be in deep water he flung himself across the hatch. Thus supported he was able to keep afloat, as long as he chose, holding the lantern aloft with his disengaged hand. Propelled by his feet, he steered round and round the pool, ascending each time by one of the back streams, and descending in the middle of the current. At first he could see nothing. Then amidst the glistening of the whirlpools, and the white clots of foam he distinguished a woman's bonnet floating alone. His search was now under the left wall, when something came to the surface almost close beside him. It was not, as he had expected, a woman, but a man. The Riddleman put the ring of the lantern between his teeth, seized the floating man by the collar, and, holding onto the hatch with his remaining arm, struck out into the strongest race, by which the unconscious man, the hatch, and himself were carried down the stream. As soon as Venn found his feet dragging over the pebbles of the shallower part below, he secured his footing, and waded towards the brink. There, where the water stood at about the height of his waist, he flung away the hatch, and attempted to drag forth the man. This was a matter of great difficulty, and he found as the reason, that the legs of the unfortunate stranger were tightly embraced by the arms of another man, who had hitherto been entirely beneath the surface. At this moment his heart bounded to hear footsteps running towards him, and two men, roused by Thomason, appeared at the brink above. They ran to where Venn was, and helped him in lifting out the apparently drowned persons, separating them, and laying them out upon the grass. Venn turned the light upon their faces. The one who had been uppermost was Eobright. He who had been completely submerged was Wildev. Now we must search the hole again, said Ven. A woman is in there somewhere. Get a pole. One of the men went to the footbridge and tore off the handrail. The Riddleman and the two others then entered the water together from below as before, and with their united force, probed the pool forwards to where it sloped down to its central depth. Ven was not mistaken in supposing that any person who had sunk for the last time would be washed down to this point, for when they had examined to about halfway across, something impeded their thrust. Pull it forward, said Ven, and they raked it in with the pole till it was close to their feet. Ven vanished under the stream, and came up with an armful of wet drapery enclosing a woman's cold form, which was all that remained of the desperate Eustacia. When they reached the bank, there stood Thomason, in a stress of grief, bending over the two unconscious ones who already lay there. The horse and cart were brought to the nearest point in the road, and it was the work of a few minutes, only to place the three in the vehicle. Ven led on the horse, supporting Thomason upon his arm, and the two men followed, till they reached the inn. The woman who had been shaken out of her sleep by Thomason had hastily dressed herself, and lighted a fire, the other servant being left, to snore on in peace at the back of the house. The insensible forms of Eustacia, Klim, and Wildev were then brought in and laid on the carpet, with their feet to the fire. When such restorative processes as could be thought of were adopted at once, the stableman being in the meantime sent for a doctor. But there seemed to be not a whiff of life in either of the bodies. Then Thomason, whose stupor of grief had been thrust off a while by frantic action, applied a bottle of hartshorn to Klim's nostrils, having tried it in vain upon the other two. He sighed. Klim's alive, she exclaimed. He soon breathed distinctly, and again did she attempt to revive her husband by the same means, but Wildev gave no sign. There was too much reason to think that he and Eustacia both were forever beyond the reach of stimulating perfumes. Their exertions did not relax till the doctor arrived, when one by one, the senseless three were taken upstairs and put in two warm beds. Ven soon felt himself relieved from further attendance, and went to the door, scarcely able yet to realize the strange catastrophe that had befallen the family in which he took so great an interest. Thomason surely would be broken down by the sudden and overwhelming nature of this event. No firm and sensible Mrs. Eobright lived now to support the gentle girl through the ordeal, and whatever an unimpassioned spectator might think of her loss of such a husband as Wildev, there could be no doubt that for the moment she was distracted and horrified by the blow. As for himself, not being privileged to go to her and comfort her, he saw no reason for waiting longer in a house where he remained only as a stranger. He returned across the heath to his van. The fire was not yet out, and everything remained as he had left it. Ven now bethought himself of his clothes, which were saturated with water to the weight of lead. He changed them, spread them before the fire, and lay down to sleep. But it was more than he could do to rest here, while excited by a vivid imagination of the turmoil they were in at the house he had quitted, and, blaming himself for coming away, he dressed in another suit, locked up the door, and again hastened across to the inn. Rain was still falling heavily when he entered the kitchen. A bright fire was shining from the hearth, and two women were bustling about, one of whom was Ollie Dowden. "Well, how is it going on now?" said Ven in a whisper. "Mr. Eobright is better, but Mrs. Eobright and Mr. Wildev are dead and cold. The doctor says they were quite gone before they were out of the water." "Ah, I thought as much when I hauled them up. And Mrs. Wildev?" "She is as well as can be expected. The doctor had her put between blankets, for she was almost as wet as they that had been in the river, poor young thing. You don't seem very dry, Riddleman." "Oh, 'tis not much. I have changed my things. This is only a little dampness I've got coming through the rain again. Stand by the fire. Mrs. says you be to have whatever you want, and she was sorry when she was told that you'd gone away. Then drew near to the fireplace, and looked into the flames in an absent mood. The steam came from his leggings, and ascended the chimney with the smoke, while he thought of those who were upstairs. Two were corpses, one had barely escaped the jaws of death, another was sick and a widow. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.